150 years ago, Charles Darwin revolutionized biology, didn't he? But did he refute intelligent design, the assertion that certain features of the universe and life are best explained by an intelligent cause? Up next, Signature in the Cell, Dr. Stephen Meyer. He argues and presents a compelling new case for intelligent design based on revolutionary discoveries in science. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Stephen C. Meyer received his PhD from the University of Cambridge in the philosophy of science. A former geophysicist and college professor, he now directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. 2004, he ignited a firestorm of media and scientific controversy when a biology journal at the Smithsonian Institution published his peer-reviewed scientific article advancing the theory of intelligent design, and he has put a lot of it now into this work, Signature in the Cell. Stephen, how are you?
I'm just doing great, George. It's great to be on with you.
You kind of stuck your neck out on this one, didn't you?
Well, it's a controversial subject, to be sure.
It is, but some of your peers, I think, agree with you.
Oh, there's a growing body of scientific opinion that's supportive of intelligent design, and maybe even a larger group of scientists who are skeptical about modern forms of Darwinism and other materialistic theories, certainly theories about the origin of life, the origin of the very first life, which is what my book is about.
When we get into some cellular DNA, I'm going to get a little biology course from you, and we all will, Stephen. You can bring us up to speed on where we're at with that. Let's go back a little bit, though, to Charles Darwin. Brilliant mind, didn't have the kind of equipment we have today, didn't have the kind of technology, yet he was able to come up with his theories. But you think he fell a little short, don't you?
Well, I have great admiration for Darwin. He was a brilliant scientist. He put together a very compelling case based on what he knew at the time. Many people may realize this is the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species, 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth, and there's a lot of discussion this year about Darwin's legacy. What did he show us? What did he prove? Well, he gave us the idea of natural selection, the idea of common ancestry of organisms. But I think the central thing that many historians of science and many biologists claim is that he refuted the argument from design, the idea that there was a designing intelligence behind life. And yet, as we move into this anniversary year, there's more and more voices of dissent among leading scientists about the sufficiency of his supposed designer substitute mechanism, the idea that natural selection could produce the appearance of design without itself being guided or directed in any way. And but setting the debate about his specific theory aside, not many people realize it, but Darwin himself never addressed the origin of the very first life. And his subsequent generations of scientists have been unable to solve that mystery, too. And yet, it's at that point where you find the most compelling evidence of design, write it down at the cellular level.
Is this accurate to say that his theory of evolution is based on the premise, of course, that everything descended from a common ancestor, and birds and bananas and fish and flowers, everything is somewhat related? Is that
true?
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And putting it in context, there's two branches of evolutionary theory. There's what you might call biological evolution. That's the idea that all living forms descended from a simple common ancestor as the result of a purely undirected process, such as natural selection acting on random mutations. That was Darwin's theory. But as he explained in The Origin of Species, he presupposed that life had arisen from, as he put it, one or a few simple forms. And he never explained where those first few simple forms or the first life came from. And that's a question that's dogged evolutionary theory ever since. It's formally addressed by the branch of evolutionary theory called chemical evolutionary theory that attempts to explain how we get the first life from non-living chemicals. Darwin didn't solve that problem, and subsequent generations of scientists, as I mentioned, have failed to do so as well. It's almost universally recognized to be an outstanding mystery in modern biology.
Okay, here we are, Darwin's 200th birthday, 150 years since he published The Origin of the Species. During this time period, Stephen, what were the scientists of the day saying about his theories?
Well, there have been a number of different phases in the evaluation of Darwin's theory. In the time just immediately after The Origin of Species, there was published in 1859 and ensuing, I would say, first couple decades, there was a lot of initial interest, but many scientists at the time were not convinced that natural selection had the creative power that Darwin had assigned to it. So many scientists accepted some kind of evolution had taken place, but they weren't sure it was done by natural selection. Later in the 1930s and 40s, some scientists coupled the idea of natural selection with the idea of mutations. And then in the 50s, after Watson and Crick discovered DNA, people figured the mutations were taking place in the DNA, and that kind of rescued the theory for a while. But by the 1980s, 90s, and right up to the present, there's been a long-standing tradition of dissent that I think has grown more and more strong as we learn more about what's going on inside the cell, just how much information is packed into the genome, what would have to be produced by mutations to really produce anything really novel. And even setting those questions aside, there's still this nagging question of the origin of the very first life. How do you get from chemicals to a living cell?
Can you be an evolutionist and a creationist at the same time?
Oh, yeah. It just depends on how you define the terms. And both terms are a little bit, they can mean lots of different things, which is one of the reasons the scientists who are advocating intelligent design, such as myself, have tried to define terms with a little more precision and reframe the debate. Evolution, let's just start with the E word, because it's got several meanings, at least three. It can mean change over time. It can mean common ancestry or universal common ancestry. And then it can mean that there's a purely undirected mechanism, namely natural selection, that can produce the appearance of design without there being any design involved, any actual guiding hand involved in the process by which the appearance of design it has been produced in living organisms. Richard Dawkins says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. That's a classically Darwinian or neo-Darwinian point of view. The theory of intelligent design is not challenging the first two meanings of evolution, change over time or even common ancestry. Instead, it's challenging this idea that life looks designed, but it isn't really because there's this unguided, undirected, mindless mechanism that's doing all the important creative work. That's what we're challenging. We say, no, things look designed because they really are designed, and living organisms bear some very distinctive hallmarks of intelligent activity, which can be detected scientifically.
Now, in your book, Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, you insist that life on Earth was preceded, guided, planned by an intelligent being or beings that was here before any creature in our evolutionary history ever lived. You advance the theory of intelligent design, but I want your theory on what intelligent design may be.
Well, let's start maybe with first some of the evidence, then some of the reasoning, and then we can talk about the implications. The evidence for intelligent design is manifold. There's lots of different lines of evidence. You find it in physics and cosmology and the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry. You find it in molecular machines. A very elegant case for intelligent design has been made by Michael Behe, a biochemist from Lehigh University, talking about the nanotechnology, the rotary engines, the sliding clamps, the turbines that are found inside cells, all on a miniaturized scale, the circuitry as well. My book addresses a third and maybe even the most fundamental evidence for intelligent design, and that's the evidence of the digital code that's stored in the DNA molecule that is actually responsible for building all those proteins and protein machines that are the subject of, for example, Behe's work. And what I argue is that the information that is stored in the DNA molecule is pointing back to a designing intelligence. Now, why do I say that? It has to do with what we know about the cause and effect structure of the world. Our local hero in Seattle, Bill Gates, says that DNA is like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever created. And that's a very suggestive remark because we know that programs always come from programmers. And in fact, we know generally that information, whether it's in a computer program or a hieroglyphic inscription or in a headline in a newspaper or a block of text in a book, information always comes from an intelligent source. So
yes,
when we find information in the DNA molecule, the most logical thing to conclude is that it, too, had an intelligent source. And therefore, we have a strong scientific basis for inferring intelligent design, because the connection between information and intelligence is confirmed by our uniform and repeated experience. That's what we know from our experience about what it takes to produce information-rich code.
Why did it take science so long, Stephen, so very long, to even get to the point where they would even talk about this?
Well, that's a really interesting question. In the 19th century, it made a lot of sense for Darwin to try to explain away design. He had this mechanism of natural selection seemed to have some powers that we had traditionally associated with, for example, ranchers or sheep herders or breeders. What was called in the 19th century artificial selection was something that Darwin thought that natural selection could mimic. You have pigeon breeders was his famous example, and they would select certain traits that they wanted to see maximized or amplified in a population. And so they wanted puffier necks. They'd only select pigeons with the puffiest necks to breed with each other, and after a number of generations, they'd get a dramatic increase in the puffiness of the necks. And since in the 19th century, many biologists thought that the way that organisms were adapted to their environments was one of the key evidences of design, Darwin's mechanism seemed to explain one appearance of design. But in subsequent generations, we've learned that there's a lot more fundamental evidences of design, whether we're talking about the body plans of whole organisms or whether we're talking about the miniature machines, the nanotechnology that we now know runs the show in the cells, or whether we're talking about the digital code that we now know directs the construction of all that nanomachinery and circuitry. So these kinds of discoveries have kind of outstripped the Darwinian mechanism, and they certainly have done so at the level of the origin of the first life. So why has it taken so long? Partly because there was a plausible idea that science, you know, allowed to have a good run, and scientists have gone with that for a long time. But the other part of it is, I think that once an idea gets established in science, it's sometimes hard to break out of an established way of thinking. And even so, there were some rules that were set up that said, hey, if you're going to be a scientist, you got to explain everything by reference to matter and energy alone, by reference to material processes. You can't talk about mind or intelligence. That would be religious or philosophical. We can't bring that into a scientific explanation. And so here we have, since the late 1950s, with the discovery of the information-bearing properties of DNA, a feature of life that bears all the hallmarks of intelligent activity, but there was a kind of convention in science that said, hey, we can't really consider that approach. And what my book does is attempt to break some new ground, not only by looking at what we've known since the 1950s, but all the new discoveries about DNA and the human genome many new discoveries in genomics that point to design and say, hey, it's time to reassess that convention that's prevented us from considering design as a powerful explanation.
I can't wait later until we get into the originator of some of this with you. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Let me ask you this. I've got to ask you this. When you were growing up as a little boy, were you raised in a spiritual environment? And then you went into science and you loved all that. And I assume you're like me, Stephen. This happened at a young age, your interest in what you ended up doing for your livelihood. Or did you evolve into this belief of an intelligent design?
Well, I was raised in a nominally Catholic home.
Like me.
I think it was important to my mother, but not my dad. And, you know, the very typical kind of upbringing. And it wasn't something that really caught with me at a young age. But I was fascinated with science. I dinosaured four, and actually, I think it even went back a little further. I got a great big fat book from my grandmother about dinosaurs from the Natural History Museum in New York. And I had all the plastic models. And, you know, but it's interesting. I was very interested in the historical sciences. And one of the things I'm sure we'll discuss is how the discussion of the origin of the first life is essentially a question of history. And during my doctoral training in Cambridge, I was fascinated with the possibility that it may be the evidence could might be there to make a compelling case for intelligent design, and I wanted to find out if it could be done in a rigorous scientific manner. So oddly, things came full circle for me because I was studying the works of Darwin and this historical scientific method that he used, and I ended up realizing that Darwin's own method of scientific reasoning, when applied to what we now know that he didn't know, actually points to intelligent design. It actually revives the design argument based on biology.
But you were raised with some basis of belief, right?
Sure. I had a sense of that there was probably a God, and later I had a philosophical I guess I had a period of existential angst in late high school and through college, but I eventually did come to a religious faith, and I'm a traditional theist, a Christian, in fact. But interestingly, I had accepted pretty much the standard evolutionary account of things, and when I was in college, I had professors who also had a spiritual belief, who believed that that they were kind of theistic evolutionists. I got interested in this whole case for intelligent design later, and it changed not so much my religious belief, but my scientific beliefs about origins.
See, Darwin lacked any spiritual influences when he was younger, and I'm wondering if that pushed him in his direction.
Well, the Darwin family was really interesting. His grandfather was a very well-known skeptic. Then there was faith in his family of origin, and then he married a Christian woman. So he had he was surrounded by it, but also Erasmus Darwin, his grandfather, was one of the first real materialist evolutionists. So it was I can imagine there were some pretty interesting discussions around the Darwin's dinner table over a couple of different generations. So, he was wrestling with all these things. At the end of his life, he confessed to being a hopeless muddle, as he put it, about metaphysics, about whether God existed or not. But one thing is clear is that he meant his theory to refute the idea of design. He was trying to show that natural selection could do what intelligent selection had heretofore been thought to be necessary to do, and therefore there was no need to invoke a creator or intelligent agent of any kind in the origin of all the new forms of life that he was attempting to explain.
If you were in a room with Darwin today, let's say he was alive, would he be listening to you and your theories, your thoughts, or would he be screaming at you?
Well, I hope so, because I very consciously built my case for intelligent design around the method of reasoning that he used. He was a pioneer in the development of historical scientific reasoning. He was trying to explain events in the remote past. And if you're looking at an event in the remote past, you don't have the luxury of observing it directly under controlled laboratory conditions where you can cause something to be repeated. So what you have to do is try to reconstruct what happened in the past from the clues that are left behind. It's much more like what a detective does. And what you attempt to do so that you gain some rigor and purchase in this way of reasoning is you compare competing hypotheses to see which one best explains the evidence. And Darwin had a simple rule of reasoning that helped decide which among a competing set of hypotheses was likely to be the best. It's a very commonsensical rule. He said, if you're trying to explain an event in the remote past, you should look for a cause that's known to produce the effect in question. And I'm up here in Washington State. In eastern Washington, we've got a layer of volcanic ash. If you apply Darwin's rule of reasoning to that, you're going to favor the volcanic eruption hypothesis over the earthquake hypothesis, because you know that volcanoes produce layers of ash, whereas earthquakes don't. And I began to think about Darwin's method of reasoning and his rule of reasoning, and I began to apply that to this longstanding mystery in biology, the mystery of the origin of the first life and the origin of the code, the information that you need to build the first living cell. And I asked myself a question: what is the cause that we know that is capable of producing information? And I realized there was only one, and that is intelligence. And so the rather ironic conclusion came out of my deliberations, and that is that by applying Darwin's method of scientific reasoning, you actually come to the conclusion of intelligent design.
Stephen, we're going to come right back. We'll talk about DNA, the DNA enigma, as you call it, next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you don't have to be computer savvy to have Streamlink. Not at all. And for just pennies a day, you get downloads, podcasts, and you can have some fun. And you can also go back into the archives now, 1 full year to get past programs. Streamlink, part of coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Stephen Meyer, Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design. DNA enigma, Stephen. Let's go back, talk a little bit about cellular biology, and also help us a little bit with DNA. You know, some of us may not know exactly what it is and how it works.
Yeah, absolutely. We're real familiar with the DNA, or think we are, because it's in television news. We know that you establish guilt or innocence sometimes with DNA evidence. We have paternity cases that are established by DNA. Exactly what is it? What does it do? It's we're familiar with the double helix structure, and that was first discovered by Watson and Crick, James Watson and Francis Crick, back in 1953. 4 years later, Francis Crick came up with what I think is one of the most important discoveries in all of the history of biology. It was initially proposed as a hypothesis or a conjecture. It was called the sequence hypothesis, and he proposed that the four chemicals that run along the interior of the spine of that double helix function just like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in the machine code. And his bold conjecture was eventually confirmed by a series of experiments that took place over the next 8 to 10 years in a period that science historians now call the molecular biological revolution. And since then, we've been learning more and more about what DNA does and how it directs the show inside life. In subsequent waves of discovery, the Human Genome Project, something recently called the ENCODE Project, and so there's a whole wealth of things to understand about DNA, but the thing that's most important to understand from the standpoint of the topic that I've taken on is what I call the DNA enigma. First line of my book was when Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, they solved one mystery, but they created another. And the mystery they solved was the location of the hereditary information, or at least some of it, that's responsible for one generation of creatures being like the next generation. But what the mystery they created was the mystery of the origin of that information. Where did all that information, where did it come from? Where did that digital code, that four-character code, come from in the very first place? And that's what I call the DNA enigma. And that mystery is intimately connected with another mystery, the one we were discussing in the last segment of the origin of the first life. And that makes perfect sense if you think about it. I used to ask my students when I was a college professor, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And the answer they would get right away, it's code. You need new lines of code. And the same thing is true in life. If you want to build a new organism from a pre-existing organism, if you want to build a new molecular machine or a new organ or structure, you have to have information. And at an even more fundamental level, if you want to get life going in the first place, you have to have the information, the digital code that's stored in DNA and which runs the show in even the simplest living cells on Earth.
Now, DNA, it's a nucleic acid, right?
Correct.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, that refers to the chemical constituents that are part of the makeup of the molecule. Yeah.
Without it, if it didn't exist, what would happen? What would we have?
Well, you need maybe to answer that question, it's good to get a clearer picture of what DNA actually does. And we've got a good example up here in Seattle. We have the Boeing plant, and they use a technology called CAD-CAM there. It's called computer-assisted design and manufacture. And what happens in the plant is that you'll have an engineer who will be designing some mechanical parts for the airplane. And the design that he or she develops on the computer will then be embedded in some code. That code is then translated into another form of machine code, which is capable of directing the manufacturing machinery. Maybe it's a rivet arm.
To cut it out exactly.
Yes, exactly. To cut out the part or to place the rivets exactly on the right place of the plane wing or whatever it is. Now, that's a common technology used in industry. And what's going on in CAD-CAM is that digital information is directing a manufacturing process. That's what's going on inside the cell. You have inside the DNA digital code, which is then translated into another format on another molecule, another nucleic acid called an RNA molecule. That message is then taken out to a manufacturing center called a ribosome. And at that place, a very mechanical process ensues where the digital code is directing the assembly of proteins one amino acid at a time. Proteins are made of amino acids. Those are the building blocks of proteins. And then if the amino acids are arranged properly, the protein folds up into an intricate three-dimensional structure that performs a job inside the cell. The proteins are like the toolbox of the cell. They're the hammers, the saws, the wrenches, the planes. And just as the toolbox, the tools in a toolbox have a form and function relationship, the shape of the tool is largely determines what kind of a job it can do. The same thing is true of proteins, but they acquire their specific shape because of the arrangement of their parts, the amino acids, and those arrangements are determined by all the code on the DNA. So it's a mechanical assembly process, just like CAD/CAM at Boeing or at another high-tech manufacturing center.
Can DNA mutate, Stephen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It does all the time. The problem with actually, that's a bit of an overstatement. One of the fascinating things about DNA is that it replicates with such amazing fidelity. It copies itself, usually without error. And in fact, there are many systems within the cell to prevent error and to correct them once they occur. There's actually something in the cell very much like a spell check in a word processing program, which is automatically corrects certain kinds of errors in the transmission of the digital information. That said, there are mutations that occur. The question is what can they produce? How much innovation and creativity are they capable of? I'm skeptical that they can produce very much. Other scientists may disagree, but again, we're talking about biological evolution, and there's an even more fundamental question, and that is, how do you get the information in the first place before you even can start talking about mutations? And that's the problem that I call the DNA enigma, and the problem that is intimately connected to the problem of the origin of the first life, the mystery that Darwin never solved.
If, for example, we cut our hand, and all of a sudden it starts to heal up, it forms, skin grows back, looks like nothing ever happened. Is that a signature within the DNA to make that work?
Well, DNA is certainly involved with that. There's a whole what's called a protein cascade. My colleague Michael Behe has discussed that process in great detail in his book, Darwin's Black Box. And it's a fascinating system, and for readers that want to know, or listeners that want to know more about that, I direct them to Behe's treatment of that. It's very interesting.
Some science would let us believe that all this just happens. It was just there. It just happened. You know, planets are formed the way they form. You know, there's just nothing planned to it. Our life is just random. How can that be? It's too organized.
Well, it's not only organized, but there's a particular kind of organization that is present inside living organisms that's present nowhere else. There's all kinds of wonderful order in the universe, and that fascinated the earliest scientists, the Newtons and the Galileos and the Johannes Keplers. Those early scientists were fascinated with the order in the universe and the design, and they believed that science was possible because the universe had issued from an intelligent creator, and therefore we as intelligent agents could understand the order and design that had been put into the universe. But in the 19th century, a new approach to science arose in which there was an emphasis on undirected material processes. And Darwin's theory of the origin of species exemplified, it wasn't by any means the only such theory, but it exemplified the approach. And his mechanism of natural selection seemed to explain some things very well, and scientists naturally at the time extrapolated from that success and suggested that it could explain all the appearances of design that we find in the biological realm, and yet I think there are a number of things that he didn't that mechanism can't explain or hasn't explained, and it certainly, again, has not explained the origin of the first life, where you have this exquisite form of organization. It's not just a repeating order like sun up, sun down, the motions of the planets, which are highly regular. What you have in the DNA is an aperiodic form of order. It's like a language, which is one term for that is sequence specificity, or the idea that the function of the whole sequence of characters depends on the precise sequencing of the characters. So it's not a repetition like a mantra. It's a message, and more like a Shakespearean sonnet or a section of software code, where the individual characters are not repeating in a rigidly ordered way, but yet their arrangement is critical for the function of that section of text, like a section of newspaper or a section from a book.
Let's look at this planet for a moment. There's an abundance of life on this planet. Some of it similar, a lot of it different, and there must be millions and millions and millions of creatures, species, things, plants, everything on this planet. How could it be so prevalent? How could it be so massive?
Well, it's fascinating, and as I think you may remember, you've had a couple of my colleagues on before, Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez,
yes,
who wrote an incredible book called The Privileged Planet, which is about the fine-tuning of the planet, of all the conditions in the solar system that allow there to even to be a life-friendly planet like Earth, and how the Earth is in exactly the right band width from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It has, you know, so many parameters that are just right. Even the phenomenon of eclipses, which we take for granted, is something that's just seems to be very finely tuned. So there's that level. I think there's a powerful case for design to be made because of those parameters. But then when you look at life itself, and you realize that what we're seeing inside life is nanotechnology and miniaturized information technology, digital code with error correction capacity, hierarchical filing systems within the genome, distributed storage and retrieval systems for data modules, an operating system. We had for a long time the Darwinians saying that most of the genome was junk that did nothing because it didn't code for proteins. And in the last few years, we've learned that non-coding DNA is not junk at all, but overall it functions much like an operating system in a computer that's telling the other coding regions of the genome when to turn on, when to turn off, how to be regulated and expressed. And so what we're finding is layers and layers of complexity and informational complexity. There's a whole hierarchical system of information storage and retrieval and processing going on within the cell. And to think that arose by purely mindless, undirected processes, when each of those features of the informational system in the cell bears the hallmark of intelligence. That is to say, there is only one known cause for digital code, for error correction capacity, for hierarchical filing, for operating systems. And whenever we find those types of features and trace them back to their source, we're always coming to an intelligence. So I think it strains credulity especially in the information age, to think that all of those features could be the result of purely blind, dumb luck or other undirected processes.
Let's take religion out of this for a moment, because there will be a lot of people who say, the answers are right there. Let's take that away.
Yeah, I don't think you need to have religion in the picture to come to the conclusion that a designing intelligence played a critical role in the origin of life. There was one of the first scientists that began to explore the concept of intelligent design in the contemporary period. I mean, it was a very powerful and influential idea during the period of the founding of modern science. Since Darwin in 1859, design has gone out of favor, but in 1984 and then in 86, there were two critical books that were published, one by Charles Thaxton and colleagues called The Mystery of Life's Origin, and then another one by Michael Denton called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis. And Denton made a very critical point in that book. He said that the argument from design derives from a rigorous application of scientific reasoning. He said it may have religious implications, but it does not depend upon religious premises. And the way I like to put it is that the intelligent design is an inference from biological data, not a deduction from religious authority.
Well, that's a good point. Will we get the answer of how?
Well, this is a curious question. People want to know how did the designing intelligence do this? And
who did it for the intelligent designer?
Yeah. Let's set the who aside for just a minute,
because
the how is in a sense a more difficult question, because we don't know how our own minds interface with the brain and with the physical expression of thought in our bodies. If we have a thought and take pen to paper and write it down, we generate information. But at that critical mind-body interface, we have a complete mystery from the standpoint of science. It's the mystery of consciousness. It's the mystery of how deliberative thought can affect the material world. And we know that thought affects the material world. We know that thought produces information. We can know this by our own introspection of the powers of our own minds and our own consciousness. But we don't really know how that occurs. So people want to say, well, unless intelligent design can tell you how the designing intelligence generated the information, it doesn't really tell us anything. Well, I think it does tell us something. It tells us something very important. It tells us that an intelligence played a role, a conscious, deliberative agent. We can move from the effect back to the cause because we know of only one known type of cause for that type of effect. Exactly how the interface occurred, well, we don't yet understand that in the case of our own minds. So,
right.
You know, it may be a difficult thing to get a handle on.
I'm beginning to think, Stephen, that consciousness, something else within the universe, has played just an incredible role in all of this.
It's the fundamental forgotten entity in science through, I would say it was the fundamental forgotten entity in the 19th century when scientists wanted to explain everything by reference to matter and energy. And in the latter half of the 20th century, consciousness started to make a comeback, first in physics with the awareness of the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics. Even some of the strange quantum phenomena seemed to suggest that maybe behind the material world there was a great mind holding things together. But now in biology, the idea of agency or mind or consciousness is coming back in as we realize there must have been a mind responsible for all of these extraordinary informational properties and features of the living cell, the digital code, and the whole information processing system.
Don't you think, too, most people want to grasp the idea that there is intelligent design behind here? Didn't Zogby have a poll?
Oh, yeah, it's rather interesting. It's been a longstanding intuition that's been hard to beat out of people, that there must be some kind of design, some kind of purpose behind the beauty, the intricacy, the order of the natural world. But recently, the idea of intelligent design is a formal scientific theory that's been developed very recently. You know, a lot of people didn't know much about it. And a recent Zogby poll shows that since the very high-profile court case in Dover, Pennsylvania, there's been a shift in public opinion towards the idea of intelligent design. A solid majority accepts the theory, and a much smaller minority accepts Darwinism. So
mainstream media doesn't touch it, though.
Yeah, well, it's disreputable. It's kind of considered to be, you know, one of those ideas you don't want to go near. But the public gets it. Increasingly, high-profile scientists are coming on board. I had a number of great endorsements for the book from one of the leading geneticists in Britain, a National Academy member here. So I think this is an idea that's making a comeback, too.
You've had some great endorsements. We'll be back in just a moment with our guest, Stephen Meyer, on Coast to Coast AM.